Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. Season 2 is still in the works, but there were too many stories and fascinating objects to wait. So we're bringing you the mini-sodes, bite-sized episodes with the same deep dives into the people, places, and artifacts of the era. Today, we're spotlighting an object that witnessed one of the most iconic speeches in Revolutionary and American history. 2.5 centuries after it was used, Patrick Henry's paper cutter is taking center stage again. We're joined by Cody Youngblood, Director of Historic Preservation and Collections at Patrick Henry's Red Hill, to unpack the story behind this unassuming artifact.
My name is Cody Youngblood. I'm the Director of Historic Preservation and Collections at Patrick Henry's Red Hill.
For anyone who doesn't know, Red Hill is the last home and burial place of Patrick Henry, located in Charlotte County, Virginia. It was his 13th and final home, where he lived with his second wife, Dorothea Dandridge, and about 10 of their children, from 1794 to 1799. Virginians often know Patrick Henry as a fiery orator and a revolutionary figure, but it's just as important to understand him as a person, not just a politician.
There's a lot about Henry that we don't know because he just didn't write a lot down. There's no diary of his that exists. So much of what we do know about his personal life comes from his great-grandson, Edward Fontaine. And Fontaine, although he wasn't alive during his great-grandfather's life, his father, Patrick Henry Fontaine, was in his 20s when Patrick died. So he recollected a lot of stuff to his son, who then wrote this down. And it exists today in what we call the Fontaine Manuscript. But in there, Edward Fontaine goes into some great detail. He talks about Patrick Henry being a very simple gentleman who was somewhat eccentric. Many of his contemporaries came from wealth. But Henry was really the opposite in that he was raised on a farm and came to power through his own sheer will. He was well-versed in the ancient classics like his contemporaries, but he was also, as Lord Byron called Patrick Henry, the forest-born Demosthenes. I think many people, especially the older gentry who came from the wealthier English background, really looked down upon that. And in some cases, they were afraid of that because these middling, lower class people, they're getting these weird ideas about not wanting to pay taxes and wanting to go against our sovereign here. So as you'll see in many of the cartoons of the day, people like Patrick Henry were portrayed as really ridiculous, outlandish backwoods farmers. But in the end, I think Henry showed them.
While Henry rose to political power through determination and skill, much of his personal life remains in the shadows, pieced together through oral histories. What we do know reveals a man who was both deeply committed to his family and shaped by the contradictions of his time. As a husband, a father, and an enslaver, Henry's legacy is complex, marked by sometimes conflicting attributes of care, conviction, and complicity. One story that exemplifies this is connected to his first wife, Sarah Shelton, who, as some listeners may know, Henry reportedly locked in the basement of Scotchtown. Like other parts of Henry's personal life, the historic record surrounding this story is not particularly robust. What historians do know is that Sarah was likely dealing with serious mental health challenges, including violent outbursts and bouts of depression that were onset after the birth of her sixth child. In the 18th century, options for care were extremely limited and often brutal. Henry's efforts, while imperfect, were made to provide care for Sarah outside of institutional settings.
Henry's first wife is fraught with myths and misconceptions, unfortunately, because again, a lot of the historical record was not written down and it's left to oral history, which, as we know, can sometimes go into a bit of fantasy. But from what we know that Sarah Shelton was well cared for at Scotchtown. Even though she was likely relegated to a room in the basement of the home, this was an English basement. It had large windows. The floor was bricked. It had a fireplace. So during the Virginia summers, I can imagine it'd be very cool down there. And with a house full of children, the basement would be very quiet for Sarah. So in that instance, he would rather have his enslaved nurses care for Sarah at Scotchtown rather than putting her in Eastern State Hospital at Williamsburg, which was known for mistreating its residents because mental illness was so misunderstood in the 18th century. As a father, we know he was very good. Despite having 17 kids, he gave his attention to them equally. He homeschooled many children. At Red Hill, we know that he educated his grandson, Patrick Henry Fontaine, in the study of law. He taught them Greek and Latin. Even though Henry wasn't alive for most of the lives of his 77 grandchildren, he paid very close attention to their future and left them many things in his will. But at the same time, he did treat enslaved people as property. There's only one letter that exists in Henry's life that he wrote to a gentleman named Robert Pleasance in 1773, where we really get a good look into his personal conflicts with the institution of slavery. He admits that as a Christian man, this is a terrible institution to be engaged in, but at the same time, he finds that it would be a quote-unquote general inconvenience to live without his enslaved people. And ultimately, Henry would die without doing anything to push for the abolition of his enslaved persons. We know that in Henry's will, he did allow for Dorothea to free one or two of his enslaved people, quote unquote, if she wished, but we only have documentation that she freed one individual. And at the same time, she did separate 20 of the 67 enslaved individuals from Red Hill, as allowed by her husband in his will, which was the largest forced separation of enslaved people in Red Hill's history.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Unbound. Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.
As a young man, Henry bounced between careers, and not always successfully. He tried his hand at farming. Not an ideal time for him. His efforts were met with fire and drought. And storekeeping, twice. As it turns out, you do have to actually understand how credit works to make a livelihood from a storefront. But by his early 20s, he was working in his father-in-law's tavern when he started reading law. Self-taught, underqualified, and supremely confident, he convinced a panel of elite lawyers to admit him to the bar. That's when things finally clicked for our man Patrick. He launched his law career in 1763 with the Parsons Cause case, where he boldly challenged Parliament and won. That courtroom performance made him a rising star in Virginia, and just 2 years later, he won a seat in the House of Burgesses. And as we've explained in other episodes, he's eventually chosen as a delegate for the First Continental Congress.
So he ultimately is elected as a delegate to the Second Virginia Convention, and that's where we know him best because he delivers his Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech in Richmond in 1775 at that convention.
Now, let's take a closer look at the object at the heart of today's episode, Patrick Henry's paper cutter. What role could a paper cutter possibly play in one of Henry's most famous speeches?
When Henry was at the Second Virginia Convention, he held this item when he declared, "Give me liberty or give me death," and in fact pretended to plunge it into his breast as if it were a dagger. This is a really unique item because when most people see it, they say, "Oh, it looks like a tongue depressor. It belongs in my doctor's office." It's about 8 inches long, and again, imagine it looks like a big popsicle stick or a tongue depressor. So it's very thin, it's rounded on both sides. It has these long, kind of horizontal black streaks through them.
This object's simple appearance can lead to some confusion. Why is it called a paper cutter? Why not a letter opener? And for those who know a little bit about bookbinding and the paper arts, how can it be distinguished from a bone folder?
We had someone comment on Facebook, "Isn't that called a bone folder?" And technically, it could be. But Henry was not involved in printing or bookbinding in his life. In fact, paper cutters in the 18th century were really a symbol for the learned and the literate. So when you look at the bookmaking process, books are often formatted in quarto, which means full sheets that were printed with 8 pages of text, 4 to a side. They were then folded twice to produce 8 total pages, and those folded pages would be glued into the spine. So when you purchase this book and you read it for the first time, a paper cutter would be required to slice open that book's fold and allow 2 pages to separate. And as we know, Henry had a library of over 210 books at Red Hill, so he was certainly someone who would use this quite often when he would purchase his own books.
This item was once identified as ivory. However, now 250 years after Patrick Henry wielded it at the Second Virginia Convention, there are some new discoveries around the artifact.
It does have a very similar color to ivory, kind of that off-white tan color, but ivory does not have these black latitudinal lines across it. And that is really what ignited the research frenzy into the material of this piece. In fact, those lines are an indication of the presence of blood vessels. Oftentimes, in the 18th century, many things that you'd use in your daily lives, from umbrellas to stays in corsets, were made from whalebone, specifically baleen, which is really the teeth of whales, because it's very thin and very flexible. And these vessels are part of the superior alveolar artery, which delivers blood to these teeth in the whale. And these blood vessels are not present in ivory, and they help the bone to grow inside the whale's mouth, filter seafood and water. And interestingly, baleen is made from keratin, which is the same material as your fingernails, whereas ivory is made from dentine. So we can use these blood vessels to compare our item to other items of whalebone and ivory that date to the same period. And again, because whalebone was used in many things that were used by the average person in the 18th century, there's lots of baleen things that still exist in museums. The blood vessels really did match a lot of the items that we looked at, most of them being in stays and umbrella ribs, piano keys even. And we did also bring this to an ivory expert who handles these sorts of things with museums. And she did confirm that ivory does not look anything like this. So she kind of reminded us that we're on the right track here. We have not tested it chemically because that would involve some destruction. But we're really glad that these blood vessels are so obvious. They've become more obvious as the item has worn. It's really important to keep this at a steady humidity level and temperature level because just like with any other item you might have, it's very sensitive to fluctuations in that environment. If the humidity is too low, the baleen could crack. If it's too high, you have warping issues. So we really try to keep it at those steady levels. And we also try to keep it under low light as well, because too much UV radiation from the sun will make it very brittle and it could break over time.
Let's talk about Patrick Henry's flair for the dramatic. It's easy to picture him, paper cutter in hand, thrusting it toward his chest for emphasis. But that wasn't his only move. He was known to swan around in a flowing red cloak. He'd shove his glasses onto his head mid-speech, and he fully commanded a room with his presence. He even reportedly ate raw rhubarb before speaking because the natural coating soothed his throat and helped him project during long, fiery arguments. Ironically, that habit may have contributed to intestinal issues that later led to his death. Still, it helps to paint this very vivid picture of Henry as a performer. Unfortunately for historians, no one wrote down Henry's liberty or death speech as he gave it. The version known today wasn't published until 40 years later. Around 1815, William Wirt interviewed surviving eyewitnesses, piecing together the speech bit by bit. One key source was St. George Tucker, who admitted his memory was a little fuzzy, but still gave Wirt valuable fragments. And the famous line, "Give me liberty or give me death," holds up. Not a single eyewitness disputed it, and Henry's own son-in-law recalled wearing a militia shirt with those exact words a full decade before Wirt published his book in 1817. The paper cutter is not mentioned in Wirt's text. However, there are other accounts that recall the prop.
It's believed that the paper cutter descended through his family. And we really get our first eyewitness recollection of it in 1859 when former President John Tyler meets with a great-grandson of Patrick Henry's. And he recalls this great speech and this interesting paper cutter that Henry's holding. And the great-grandson says, well, guess what? I've heard the same story from my side of the family, and I own the very paper cutter of which you speak. So there again, we have some oral histories coming together. They both verify each other. And about 120 years later, the paper cutter is donated by the Henry family to Red Hill. So the idea behind Henry using this as a prop with a dagger, we believe, comes from a very popular play written by Joseph Addison in 1713 called Cato, a Tragedy. And this dramatized the final days of Cato the Younger, who was a very important Roman senator. And rather than live under the tyranny of Julius Caesar, Cato acted upon his virtues and gutted himself with his longsword. And in this play, there is a part where Cato is speaking to the Senate. He says something like, it is not now time to talk of aught, to talk of nothing, but chains or conquest, liberty or death. So using those words with the similar movement of Cato's sword, all the theater-going members of the Second Virginia Convention recognize Henry's imitation.
The phrase liberty or death would have been instantly recognizable to Henry's audience. Cato, a Tragedy, was a popular play at the time. In fact, it was a favorite of George Washington's, so the reference likely landed. But it might have also been a subtle flex, a way for Henry to say, hey, I've read the classics too. I'm just as educated as the rest of you. The paper cutter offers a physical link to one of the most iconic moments in American history, and to the man behind the words. It's a small object, but one that invites a deeper look at Patrick Henry's life beyond the speeches, his legal theatrics, his personal contradictions, and the everyday items that have outlasted generations. Thanks so much to Cody Youngblood for sharing his insights on today's minisode. Patrick Henry's Red Hill holds the largest collection of Henry artifacts in the country and is open every day except for select holidays. You can explore more at redhill.org. The paper cutter featured in this episode is on display in Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation. Learn more at virginiahistory.org/givemeliberty. Thanks for joining us for this minisode of Revolution Revisited.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Don't miss your chance to see Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture before it closes on January 4th. This special exhibition commemorates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Discover Virginia's leading role in the American Revolution and how both iconic and everyday people helped forge a new nation. Tickets at virginiahistory.org.